Good evening, everyone. Good evening and welcome. My name is Danny Hoffman, and I'm the director of the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies here at the University of Washington. So let me begin, as we always do at our Jackson School public events, by acknowledging that we are meeting on Coast Salish territory, the traditional homelands of the Duwamish, Suquamish, Tulalip, Muckleshoot, and other indigenous peoples. The Jackson School understands that the international community includes sovereign American Indian tribes, First Nations, and other indigenous peoples across the world. It's really nice to see you all. Thank you for being here. Now, those of you who know the Jackson School will know that our faculty, staff, and students share a core conviction. One does not understand the world we live in without understanding diverse cultures, without a willingness to speak and to listen in multiple languages, without recognizing that history is complex and contested, and that political, social, and economic systems are varied and interwoven. That ethos infuses our teaching, research, and our public engagements. So we're very proud to be able to continue that tradition here tonight with this inaugural talk in our War in the Middle East series, On the Ground Now in Israel, a recorded conversation with Joel Migdal, with discussion led by Rashad Kasaba and Alan Dowdy. This launches a series of events over the next 2 months that exemplify our commitment to understanding the world from many different vantage points, but always with respect and a spirit of inquiry. And for those of you who haven't seen the poster, you'll know we have a number of events over the next couple of weeks, including Monday night, the 22nd, with Mira Sucharov and Omar Jani in Kane Hall at 7 p.m. We hope you can join us for that. Now, in just a moment, I'll invite to the stage my friend, colleague, and predecessor as director of the Jackson School, Dr. Rashad Kasaba. Rashad will say more about the origins and purpose of this series. But before I do, I have two very important jobs. The first is to let you know that we will be using Slido.com for our questions, and that is not an advertising pitch. That is actually the platform we're going to be using tonight. So if you want to ask a question, the way to do that is with whatever device you have access to, you would go to Slido.com. That's Slido.com, and you'll be prompted to enter an event code. And the event code that we're using tonight is hashtag or the pound sign and then Migdal, M-I-G-D-A-L. We will put all this up on the screen after the initial presentation, so you don't have to remember that. But that will be the way that we'll handle the discussion and questions from the audience. So with that, my most important job tonight is to thank the many people who've worked so hard to make this evening and indeed this whole series possible. I'd like to thank the UW President, Annemarie Kausi, and everyone in her office, the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Diane Harris, Divisional Dean for the Social Sciences, Andrea Woody, as well as the staff in College Communications and Advancement offices. We're grateful for the continued partnership of the Jackson Foundation, with particular thanks to Katie Terry and Maura Sullivan. Now, within the school, I want to express my gratitude to the faculty and staff affiliated with the Middle East Center and those affiliated with the Strom Center for Jewish Studies. All of you have put tremendous effort into planning this series, and I want to thank you for that. A special shout-out to Kevin Swantek and Mark Haslam for their assistance with logistics, and a huge thank you to Monique Dorman for pulling all of this together. Finally, I want to thank Alan Dowdy and Rashad Kasaba for lending your expertise to this conversation. And most importantly, again, I want to thank all of you for caring enough about an informed, thoughtful public discourse to be here tonight. And with that, I'll turn things over to Dr. Rashad Kasaba.
Thank you, Danny, and thank you all for being here. So our world has become increasingly hard to comprehend, explain, and make predictions about. It seems to me like every few months, if that, we are faced with yet another catastrophe, which we quickly describe as unprecedented. What has been going on in Israel, Palestine, and Gaza clearly fit this pattern. People describe the war in apocalyptic terms. On October 7th, the largest number of Jews were brutally massacred in a single day since the Holocaust. In a relatively small country, the ripple effects of this event have spread and touched a very large segment of the Israeli population. In Gaza, the death toll from the war that has been going on for over 3 months is at least 23,000, half of which are children. And this corresponds to fully 1% of the population in Gaza. Looking at this death toll, displacement, destruction, the onset of disease, hunger, and imminent famine, the University of Chicago's Robert Pape described the war in Gaza as one of the most intense civilian punishment campaigns in history. This is indeed without a precedent, and we are likely to live with this war and with its consequences for a very long time. Jackson School, as Danny mentioned, has a tradition of responding to events like this. I've been here long enough that I remember when Berlin Wall came down. We mobilized our faculty to talk about this. Similarly with 9/11, with the Iraq War, and when Trump was elected president. All of these events we saw as events that were going to change how we think about the world and how things were likely to unfold. And we held public events such as this one, where our community and students participated in informed conversation. So our purpose in setting up this series is to share what we know with our students and with our community, and to create an environment where we can learn from each other. We are always encouraged with the tremendous interest that our students show in learning and having difficult conversations, and grateful to our community for their support and their interest in being part of these events. We come to these conversations across many divisions and with many different beliefs. And these beliefs come from our family, from our communities, from our background, and from where we are grown up, etc. Often, what we believe shape how we see the world. There is, with apologies to the president of University of California, I don't believe there is a value-neutral way of talking about these events. So we don't intend here to change anybody's beliefs, and these conversations are designed with the hope that we will find a space to listen, reflect, ask questions, learn new ways of thinking and understanding our world. And perhaps through these conversations, we gain a better understanding of our own beliefs as well. To help us in this endeavor, we did put together a series of presentations by experts here at the University of Washington and elsewhere. We are not presenting dueling perspectives here. There will be more of a conversation, and you will find that there will be more overlaps in what people will be saying than disagreements and differences. At the end of the day, we are hoping that we will fill something like a jigsaw puzzle, and hopefully we will get a better understanding of what's going on. So we can't, unfortunately, stop the war. We may wish that we could, but we can't. But at least, hopefully, we can get some knowledge, and we can use this knowledge to persuade those who may be in a position to affect change. I feel privileged to be a part of this conversation, and I've always felt really privileged being a part of the University of Washington and the Jackson School of International Studies. Tonight's event is somewhat different from the others. Our colleague Joel Migdal is in Jerusalem, so I had a conversation with him on Thursday, which we recorded. We will hear that conversation first, and then my other colleague, Alan Doughty, who we're very privileged to have here as a visitor, will comment on Joel's interview, and then we will open it up for Q&A. Many of you know Joel. He's Professor Emeritus at the Henry M. Jackson School of International Studies, and he was the founding chair of the University of Washington's International Studies program. He is one of those rare faculty members who received the University of Washington's Distinguished Teaching Award and also the University of Washington's Marshall Landholt Distinguished Graduate Mentor Award. He has written numerous books articles, open op-ed pieces on Israel, Palestine, but also in the broader issue of state-society relations in the Third World. He's one of those rare scholars who actually has a school of thought that he originated in state-society relations. So we're very privileged that he was willing to have this conversation, although he didn't feel like he could make the trip, unfortunately, and he couldn't be up at 3 a.m. to have this conversation live either. Alan Doughty is an affiliate faculty member at the Strom Center for Jewish Studies and is a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Notre Dame. He taught previously at Hebrew University in Jerusalem and also at the University of Calgary. He has written numerous books. Among them is a basic text on Israel-Palestine that's been used widespread in all the universities and is in its fourth edition, and also hundreds of articles, popular and scholarly. So I can't imagine a more informed person than Alan to comment on the conversation and to be part of the broader Q&A after the event. So with that now, we're going to start the video, and then afterwards, I will invite Alan to say a few things, and then we will do the Q&A. Thank you very much. Good evening. Joel, thank you so much for making time and joining us for this conversation. We are fortunate that you are there and you are someone who has been thinking about and writing about the Middle East, Israel, Palestine, and broader issues of state-society relations for a long time. So I can't imagine a better observer of what is going on in Israel, in the war in Gaza, and we are really looking forward to some of your impressions. So I would like to start with October 7, and I would like to ask you what that day was like for you. When did you hear about the attacks for the first time, and when did you realize the scope of it, and then when did you start thinking about the broader consequences of this?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me, and it's really good to be back at the UW, even though it's via Zoom and virtual. The war started on October 7th, and that was a Saturday and also was a holiday in Israel. And so usually I sleep in a little later, but although my phone was silenced, it started buzzing like crazy, one buzz after another. And I couldn't quite figure out what that was. And that was, it turned out to be alerts that rockets were being fired into Israel. And shortly thereafter, there was a siren and we had to go to a shelter in order to be safe. And there were 12 sirens in Jerusalem that day. So we were running in and out of this room that serves as a shelter for us. It was quite unnerving. At first, we thought, well, this is just another little flare-up that we've seen before in the Middle East. But very quickly, it became clear that something else was happening. And then the reports began to filter in that the border had been breached and that there was a massacre in progress as we were watching and listening that day. Both my wife Peggy and I have friends. Her friend Vivian Silver was a well-known peace activist, and report came fairly quickly that she had been taken hostage into Gaza. That actually turned out to be false. She was burned alive in her house in the kibbutz of Be'eri. And I, my friend and colleague and former student from the University of Washington, whom many of you have heard about, Chaim Katzman, and we got first a report that Chaim was missing. He lived in a kibbutz right near the Gaza border. And then later we got the report that he had been shot. His case became quite well known. He was in a closet with a woman neighbor when the Hamas came into his apartment and opened the door. He put himself in front of the woman. He took the shots and was killed. She was saved. She managed to run away and gather two children from the kibbutz. She was then caught again and taken to Gaza with the two children. And then for reasons that nobody quite understands, she was told, get out of here. And she ran back as fast as she could with the two children. And Chaim's actions really saved them. So this was extremely upsetting to me. I had worked on Chaim's doctoral dissertation with him and had been a colleague of his when he was here in Israel. I've given a number of talks on his work and on his life. It was a kind of presaging of this terrible event that had occurred that day, which really didn't become clear of how how momentous it was and how huge it was for a couple of days.
Yes, thank you. I mean, Chaim was someone that we all knew here quite well, and it was really a very sad way of connecting with this tragedy from its very first days. I just want to go now a little bit into detail. So when people talk about this problem, they talk about Israelis and Palestinians and Israel-Palestine conflict, and this is a short cut, I guess, short way of talking about something very complicated. I know this is a question that you really spend a lot of time thinking about in other contexts too. So can you talk a little bit about especially the divisions within the Israeli society? How did this event really affect the society itself, and what did that do to the divisions that were already there?
It was really complex. So up until the day before the war, there had been nine straight months of protests against the government, which was trying to change the judiciary and basically denude the court and the checks on the prime minister and the cabinet. It was seen as a threat to democracy. Every Saturday night, hundreds of thousands of people were out on the street, especially in Tel Aviv, but in 135 other communities as well. So there were tremendous divisions between the government and those who were supporting the government and the protesters, who made up a larger and larger proportion of the population. So when the war broke out, it was a very, very divided population. There was a lot of rancor, a lot of anger in Israeli society, particularly at the government. And in fact, there was a big protest planned for the night of October 7th, and that never happened. What was amazing afterwards is how the society came together almost instantaneously. All the organizations that had been working towards bringing down the government and preventing that kind of change towards an unbridled government, they switched gears quickly and began to work towards the damage that was done to Israel. One major organization was called Brothers in Arms. They were later called Brothers and Sisters in Arms. It was people who had been in the army who were working against the government, trying to prevent the fall of democracy. They pivoted so that within a day, they had 10,000 people on the streets and in cars working to help civil society deal with the tremendous trauma that had occurred. And within a week, they had 60,000 people. Their logistics were amazing. You know that Israel is a high-tech society. It's called Startup Nation. All those companies and high-tech scientists who had been working against the government switched gears, and they began to try and identify who was killed, where are they, using all these kinds of high-tech solutions. So there was a tremendous unification of civil society. And at the same time, the government was almost non-functioning. They had not been prepared for this war. Many of their actions had, in fact, encouraged some of the things that Hamas did. And when the society had to be dealt with, people were being evacuated from the front. They were being moved into hotels. There were people who were wounded and the hostages and all these kinds of things. The government did very little. It took really, I would say, 2 months for the government to kind of get itself together. And in that time, when the government was non-functioning, it was civil society that really stepped in. Now, is Israeli society permanently unified, and are they showing solidarity? On one hand, yes. On the other hand, there is quite a division on what do we want from this war. The families of the hostages have been adamant that they want a ceasefire, which would bring back the hostages, they believe. The government has been unwilling to do a ceasefire. There are people who feel that the future lies in a two-state solution, and there are others who feel, no, you can never trust the Palestinians. So there are divisions brewing, but at this point, civil society is still pretty unified.
So I just want to ask two questions, one about the society, the other about the state side of it. So the divisions in Israel that we've been reading about before October 7th and, you know, they're likely to come up again in some form or another. Can you say anything about the class dimension of these divisions? Is it just a division in terms of political preferences or a vision of Israeli constitution? Or this is also a question one of our students raised, for example, Russian immigrants, people who have come at different points in time, etc., or people who were born in Israel. Is there any parallel, or can you talk about these divisions in terms of that kind of background?
Right. So Israel is a complicated society. It consists of different subgroups. Arabs make up about 21-22% of the citizens of Israel. This is not counting the occupied territories, but the actual citizens of Israel. You also have Jews who came from Middle Eastern countries and North Africa. They're called Mizrahim or Sephardim sometimes. You have Jews who came from Europe. They're Ashkenazim. And you have also about a million Jews coming from Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. So you have a lot of different groups, or smaller groups too, groups of Ethiopian Black Jews and from other societies. But basically, these are the different groups. There's no doubt that when these protests started, they started largely among the center left people who had voted for center or left parties, and they tended to be Ashkenazim, who tended to be more of the elite of the society. But as time went on, from the beginning of those demonstrations in January of 2023, more and more people began to join. You had people from the right wing, from the Likud party, which was the dominant party. You had religious Jews who had, at the beginning had not been very evident among the demonstrators. You had definitely had Russian Jews. So it became more of a general protest than it had been at the beginning. You're muted.
I just want to follow up on this before I turn to the state side of this, the government side. How about the generational shift? And one thing that we are seeing in this country in relationship to the Democratic Party is that there's appearing to be a very significant change in terms of attitudes and the kinds of things people support and how they see themselves in relationship to the Democratic Party. Is there that kind of, can you see that kind of pattern in Israel? I know a large number of young people were killed at that music festival, and I'm sure that had some impact. But overall, do you see that kind of change in Israel too, generational change?
Well, it's somewhat different. So Israel, since the beginning of the 21st century, has been drifting towards the right, towards more hawkish right-wing stances. And this has been particularly evident among young people. Young people tend to vote more for the right than they do for the left, which is the opposite of the United States. Much of this came as a result of the Second Intifada, which was at the beginning of the 21st century, went on for almost 5 years, in which both Israeli and Palestinian societies were really traumatized and hardened positions between them. And I think we're seeing a lot of the fallout of that Intifada, both among Palestinians and Israelis right now. So you had this right-wing drift, and really we had right-wing governments since almost for the entire 21st century. The question is, and it's a very interesting question, nobody knows the answer to it yet. Definitely Israel is a changed society as a result of what happened October 7th and this ongoing war. And the protests before also were already changing the society. So you had a lot of turmoil in 2023, and it's really unclear exactly how that's going to affect the political alignments in Israel, whether youth are going to really begin to question their more right-wing views and move towards the left or the center, or whether it will harden their views. We really don't know the answers to those questions yet.
Interesting. So let's turn to the government. And I mean, the thing that when we talked about this with some students too, one thing that really leads me to kind of wonder about is that came up a number of times is that this is supposed to be really a high-tech society and very advanced methods of protection and warfare, the strongest state in the Middle East militarily, probably. And so how was this possible? So one explanation is that they were focused on other things and they didn't really think something like this would come from Gaza. But still, it's a question that we are wondering about. How is it that the state, Israeli state, appeared to be so incapable of protecting its people, which, after all, was supposed to be one of its major reasons for existence? So what is your take on this? And then I will follow up with the possible kind of future unfolding of this in terms of government's position.
Okay. So a lot of this we will learn when there are going to be state commissions of inquiry. They're coming, and they're going to be analyzing, once the war winds down, analyzing what happened and why the government, the army, and the intelligence services perform so badly. And one of the interesting elements is that there was a cadre of young women soldiers who were on the Gaza border, and their job was to watch what was going on in Gaza. Most of them are dead now. And they, before the war, before October 7th, for weeks were saying, something is happening. We see activity that presages a possible invasion. And they were dismissed. And in fact, at one point, they threatened them with court-martialing if they continued to give these reports. And one must ask, why? Why were they dismissed? They were seeing things with their own eyes. And we know from the New York Times that they were already in the hands of the Israelis, plans by Hamas to attack Israel as far back as 2018 in Israeli hands, the overall plan. And I think the answer goes to what the Israelis call the conception. That is, you have a framework in which you absorb information. And their belief was, and this was headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, that Hamas was, in a sense, an ally, and that it would never seriously attack Israel. Both Hamas and Israel and the Netanyahu government didn't want a two-state solution, which we can talk more about later. And the Netanyahu government basically winked at the movement of resources into Gaza to help Hamas and to solidify it, with the idea that they were the opponents to Fatah, which is the Palestine Authority in the West Bank, and that Fatah wanted a two-state solution. Netanyahu did not want that. And so by strengthening Hamas, he thought he could prevent the Palestine Authority from moving towards a two-state solution. Now, this led them to believe that Hamas also liked the deal. They would lob rockets at each other, have a little flare up every few years, but it wasn't going to be anything serious. They would never do anything serious. And so even when they had information to the contrary, their conception and worldview of what was happening didn't allow them to take that material seriously.
So from starting from that, and then the way the war is being conducted, and then the confusion about what the end game is, the various voices that are coming out of the Israeli cabinet and conflicting plans, etc., all of this shows that this is a massive failure on the part of the government. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any part of what happened since October 7th and even before that can be seen as a success of any conception or any vision or any plan. So is it too cynical to think that Netanyahu is insisting on continuing this war right now, or delaying its end as much as possible, because
at the end of the day, there will be the inquiry commissions and possibly his continuing legal troubles. Is that a too cynical take on this, or is there another explanation?
Oh, let me give a little background, and then I'll try and get to what you're getting at. So the various agencies, the Army, the Shin Bet, the intelligence agency, the Mossad, and so on, all of their top leaders have taken responsibility for what happened. And they said, we have sinned. We messed up. We did terribly. And the only one who has not done that is Netanyahu, who has taken no responsibility for what the massive failure that you talked about, because it was a massive failure. And interestingly, first, most of those leaders of those organizations almost certainly will resign when the war is over because of the failure to judge what had happened and to see what was happening. At the same time, the Israeli, in the surveys that have been taken, and there are surveys every day practically here, in the surveys that have been taken, the confidence in the army is very high, even though the army messed up terribly. The confidence in the intelligence agencies is very high. The confidence in Netanyahu is at an all-time low, basically 15% approve of his handling of the job in the last poll. 15% is extremely low, makes Biden's approval ratings look out of this world. So there is a lot of speculation because of this, and because Netanyahu is on trial for corruption, that in fact he wants to continue this war because it will save his skin, because he will probably have to face the consequences once the war is over. My personal opinion is that he's almost certain to leave office or be thrown out of office. I have to say that I am not quite that cynical to see him doing that. That is to see him as prolonging the war simply to save his skin. There's certainly a lot of speculation in the press about that. My personal opinion is that's not what's happening.
Do you have any sense of who is likely to benefit from Netanyahu's demise, if that comes?
Yeah, so it could come from three different sources, at least. One is within the Likud party, his party. Now, he has ruled that party with an iron hand. And if anybody rose up to a position where they might in the future threaten him, he got rid of them. So there are not many independent souls in that party right now. A lot of what happened to that party is very similar to what has happened to the Republican Party in the United States under Trump. Nonetheless, there are a few people, and you only need five of them for the government, for him to be out. There are a few people who might challenge him. One has already announced that he's challenging him, the former mayor of Jerusalem. There are others, a former immigrant from the Soviet Union. One possibility is that within the Likud party, they present a different leader. That's one possibility. A second possibility is in the opposition, there is a former chief of staff general named Benny Gantz. And Gantz now in the polls far, far outpaces Netanyahu as who would be the best prime minister. The surveys show him hands down as the public selection. So another possibility is that the government falls, that there are elections, or that there is a reordering of the government in some way, and Gantz comes out. A third possibility is that from the protest movements and civil society, institutions and organizations come out that will challenge the existing political setup. I think this is the least likely of the three. There's already a figure who is mentioned. His name is Yair Golan, who is also a former general. He's of the left, left center. And he has already started a movement called Awakening in English to try and get power. So there will be a lot of turmoil and a lot of jockeying when Netanyahu goes on how this is going to sort itself out.
Yes. So let's just turn to the war itself and the death toll is huge. I mean, the known number is over 23,000. More than 80% of the homes are destroyed, farms, mosques, schools, universities, and 90% of the population has been displaced. The disease, famine, and all these things, of course, are very hard actually to read about, let alone to live through those who have to do that. What is the impact of this on Israeli society, and how closely this is being followed? How much is being reported in Israeli media, and what kind of impact this is having on Israeli society?
Yeah, it's a complicated question. Israelis read about what is happening in Gaza every day in the newspapers, and they hear about it on the radio. The kinds of images that most of the world has on television of the destruction are not appearing on Israeli TV, so that the impact of those visual images is less in Israel, I think, than it may be elsewhere. There's also the issue, I mean, if you speak to people, again, Israel is not homogeneous. I'm going to speak about two groups. If you speak to people I know, my friends, the professors and the lawyers and people of this sort, there is a real empathy with what's happening in Gaza, and a real feeling of, and there's, you know, a lot of murmuring and protesting that the war needs to be fought differently. They're agreeing with the United States on how the war should be exercised. But I'm going to put a big but here. But most of their emotional energy is to the Israeli losses. Every day at 6 a.m., the names of the soldiers who were killed the previous day are announced. And every day, Israelis, that is what grips them. That's what they wait for, that moment. And who do we know? Someone, every, it's a small society. Most people know others who are killed. And of the hostages and the people who have been displaced, 300,000 people are out of their homes now. So the great force of Israeli empathy is with those who are suffering in Israel or the hostages. So there's, I don't want to call it lip service to what's happening in Gaza, but it's real, it's empathetic, but it's less intense than their feeling of what's happening in their own people. And I would also say I just want to add, I'm going to add a little bit to this one group and then speak about another group. The Israeli Palestinian citizens, okay, not in the West Bank and not in Gaza, but the people who live in Israel proper, have been highly sympathetic to Israel in this war. About 70% in the latest polls indicate that they feel highly identified with Israel and what's going on. Which is interesting because before the war, the number was about 48%. So there's really a feeling here among them, but they have tremendous empathy for what's happening to other Palestinians, and they express this a lot. The other group in Israel tends to say, look, they came to kill us. And we have to do what we have to do to eliminate them. And there's basically no differentiation between general Palestinian civilians and Hamas. And this is a position you hear on the radio, you read in the press. To me, it's very distressing. I wouldn't say it's the majority opinion, but it's definitely there as well.
One concern a lot of people have is that this as we move forward will make it very difficult to repair some of the relationships both in Israel and Palestine itself, and also in generally speaking international relations, because the United States is appearing to be the only, vocal, strong supporter of Israeli state in this. And there is some discussion as to whether this is making things difficult internationally for the US and for Israel and for what is likely to come after it ends. I'm sure this is something that you're thinking about too, and
Yeah.
you see if you think so.
Well, first of all, let me say that President Biden is the most popular person in Israel. If he has bad ratings in the United States, his ratings here are off the charts. Israelis feel he is understanding of their situation and very appreciative of the aid that the United States has given. The same time, I think President Biden has played this very, very cleverly. He has, as one observer put it, given a big hug while at the same time whispering in your ear, you can't do this anymore. Secretary of State Blinken was just here. I don't know if he's left yet today or not. But he issued a statement in which he was very, very clear that what Netanyahu is talking about in terms of how this will play out in the region and between Palestinians and Israelis afterwards is unviable. And the United States has a very different vision of this. The question is the United States really going to push hard on this and really move towards incorporating the Palestinians into the governance of Gaza and particularly the Palestine Authority? Is it going to move to reform the Palestine Authority because it's very unpopular among Palestinians because of its high level of corruption and ineffectiveness? So is it going to be reformed and will it be able eventually to help govern Gaza? These are big questions. And why from its own strategic point of view, the United States sees Iran as it's the biggest threat to regional and even international stability. Many of its allies are threatened by Iran, and it sees Iran as an aggressive part of now an axis of Russia, China, and Iran. ran supplying Russia in the Ukraine war. So the United States sees the Israel fighting Hamas at fighting a client of Iran, fighting Hezbollah, another client of Iran, fighting in the United States, suffering from the militias, pro-Iranian militias in Iraq and in Syria. So from the strategic point of view of the United States, Israel is a key player in the ability to maintain a kind of deterrent power against Iran. To do that, the United States feels that Israel must get past the Palestinian conflict. It must find some kind of solution, a two-state solution, according to Blinken and Biden, and that this is really critical to United States interests. We'll see whether it happens. I don't know.
All right. There's just so many interesting questions, and that keep coming up as I listen to you. But we're going to have to wrap up pretty soon. But I do have a few things that I want to make sure and cover. And these are more questions, a bit more general, some of them are. One is from one of our colleagues here, is the whole issue of Zionism. As you, I'm sure you know, that in the social media, there's quite a bit of chatter about Zionism as being a form of racism and the relationship between the two. And I know this is something that you've thought about a lot. And can you just say a few things about your understanding of Zionism and how it's perceived and how it's likely to be affected by what's going on now?
Yeah, so Zionism, to put it really simply, is Jewish nationalism. And the movement grew up in the late 19th century, just as European nationalism, particularly East European nationalism, was growing. And there was really no place for Jews, even in countries that they had lived in for 1,000 years. They were not considered Romanian if they were in Romania, or Hungarian if they were in Hungary. And they developed this movement, well, let's have a Jewish nationalism, our own nationalism. And that's what Zionism was and continued to be, and moved eventually towards the idea that the Jews would have their own state, that there would be a Jewish state, and that turned out to be Israel. Zionism now has different interpretations by different Zionists, nationalists, and I'll just, to make it fairly simple, just divide it into two. There is a kind of right-wing nationalism that we see all over the world. You can see it I was in Hungary a couple of years ago, and it's interesting. If you look at the Hungarian maps, they include parts of every neighbor of Hungary, right? They have an irredentist view, and they, Romania, that's us, you know? So there is a view that is chauvinistic and exclusive. And I think that has really been reflected in the particular government that we have right now, that form of Zionism. There is also what an academic, well-known academic, wrote a book with Princeton University Press, Yuli Tamir, called Liberal Nationalism, which is basically, yes, we are a group. We are Jews. We have a nationalist feeling. We're therefore Zionists. But that doesn't make us exclusive or better or chauvinistic. We coexist with other nations of the world. So I think that basically sums it up.
All right. So very quickly, do you have any thoughts about how the war is likely to end?
Oh, this is the biggest debate. Some of the students asked excellent questions and alluded to this. So what I think what's going to happen is not a dramatic ending to the war, where one day you have war and the next day there is a total ceasefire and parties come to some kind of agreement. I don't think this is going to happen. I think what you're going to have is a scaled down war, where Israel is going to continue to attack with more surgical precision, Hamas strongholds, and that this will go on for some time. The question is whether you can begin to develop a political solution at the same time that this low level of fighting goes on. And there, that's the big question again on whether the United States is going to prevail and begin to bring together. There's a big question. Who's going to turn on the lights in Gaza? Who's going to make sure that the water is clean? Who's going to run the schools? If Hamas is defeated, who's going to do all that? And certainly not the Israelis. They don't want any part of that. So the question is how we're going to form some kind of international or Palestinian force that will be able to govern Palestine and begin to rebuild it and transform it.
And that, I guess, also this was a question that came from our students too, that links up to the whole issue of two-state outcome that some are premised upon building some of these institutional structures so that something like that could be viable. Is that
Right. There were a couple of questions by students, and they were really good questions. And one student was saying that basically the Trump plan for Palestine really left something that was unviable, cut into little islands and of land that would not be viable. Is this two-state solution on the horizon? Not on the immediate horizon, that's for sure. The question is whether a process can begin that might lead within a 5 to 10 year period to a two-state solution. If I were a betting person, I would bet against it. I think it's so many obstacles to it. But if I would talk from my heart, I would say that that really is the only solution that's going to give security both to Palestinians and to Israelis. One of the students asked also, is there going to be some kind of reconciliation process? No one's talking about that now, but I had a student I advised at Tel Aviv University who really showed that you're going to need some kind of reconciliation process like they had in South Africa for a two-state solution to even be viable at all.
There was one more question from again one of our students, and that I'm curious your take on this, given your previous work too. Do you see this situation as unique, this conflict between in Israel, between Israelis and Palestinians?
Absolutely not. We have, every situation is unique, but can we put this in some kind of comparative perspective where we can glean from other conflicts? Yes, I think we can. I mean, I think that if you're looking at occupation, you can be looking at China's occupation of Tibet, you can be looking at Russia's occupation of Chechnya. You can be looking at numerous other cases of irredentism, of national conflicts of this kind. If we look back to the Yugoslav wars of the 1990s, the Croatians and the Serbs, the Bosnians and the others, they're very much akin to the kind of national clash you have here, which is basically a simple clash. Two different nations claimed the same piece of land. That's what this is about. And the question is, how in international relations can we come to come some kind of solutions where one is not totally defeated and one is totally triumphant, but where you have some kind of accommodation on this one piece of land for these two different nations?
Thank you. So just finally, I know you are one of, I don't know, handful, if that, people I know who got tremendous recognition for your teaching, both on the undergraduate and the graduate level. I know you've left the University of Washington 4 years ago, is it now, or five, something like that. But I know you continue to be involved with students. So the question I have is, if you were still here teaching big classes like some of us are, how, and if something like this happened going on, then how would you advise students to think about this and to process it, and so that they can kind of have some understanding of what's happening? What would you recommend that they do?
Yeah, it's a difficult question, and I know our students are really thoughtful. And are grappling with the big issues of the day, and this is certainly one of them. I miss our students. I'll say two things. One is the students in class and out of class have to refrain from a good guy, bad guy framework for thinking about any conflict. The oppressor and the oppressed, or whatever particular metaphor is used. On each side, there are complicated divisions. You alluded to them at the beginning on the Israeli side. The same is true on the Palestinian side. And I think when you just make one party into the victim or the oppressed, you take away all agency from that party. You take away the dynamics of what's going on within the society, the mistakes they made and the good things they do. And so it's very important to look at these conflicts from a perspective of the complexity of each side and how to think about how those different complexities interact. That's the first thing I would say. Second thing, I'm going to say something personal. I have a wonderful granddaughter. Who is in college now? She's at Yale. And one thing she and some friends did was set up a table in the middle of the campus. And this is a campus like all campuses, like University of Washington and others, which has been roiled by all kinds of protests and marches and all kinds of things. And they said, if you'd like, and they had a sign at the table. If you'd like to speak calmly and rationally about what's happening, come here. And students did. They flocked to it. So students should be looking for opportunities to talk about this in an intelligent way, to read about it, to think about it, to talk with others, no matter what, who their where their sympathies lie. I think this really could be helpful for what a true education could do for someone.
Thank you. So, well, I want to thank you just to tell you what will happen after we finish showing this to the people who will gather. We will have a discussion, which we're fortunate that it will be led by Alan Doughty. We hope that you would be with us live, but 3 o'clock in the morning in Israel is not a very good time to ask anyone to do that. So I really appreciate that you're willing to do this recording. So do you have any final things to say before we say goodbye to you?
Yes, I have a couple of things. First of all, I want to thank Alan Doughty for being there. And Alan, I should just say to the students and to the rest of the audience, is a major, major thinker, one of the great thinkers on Israel and the Israel-Palestine. He's written numerous books on this and really, really is an expert. He taught for most of his career at Notre Dame, but also taught at some other places. And we are really lucky at the University of Washington to have him here now with us. And I also want to thank a person by the name of Rashad Kasaba, who puts these things together. They're not easy to put together and has been doing it for years over major issues, Trump in the world and post 9/11 and now this. I think this is so important in getting past the kind of rancor that we see in American society now, the polarized society, to get to where people can really listen and talk and learn at a sophisticated level. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Joel. You have been an inspiration to all of us all the time that you've been here and continue to be. Thank you, and we'll say goodbye to you, and this will be the end of our recording, and hopefully now I'm looking forward to a good discussion with the audience and with Alan. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes. All right, so I'm turning it over to Alan now, who will say a few things before we get on to Q&A.
Thank you very much. I should also thank Joel for his kind words and maybe return the favor. I found this entire interview to be tremendously insightful. As a view from the inside, you really couldn't have asked for much more. So my job here is basically just to underline some of what he said. Not at great length, but and maybe fill in a bit. First of all, I think what comes across here very clearly is the extent of the shock, the tremendous shock of October 7th in Israel. As most Israelis saw it, they had evacuated from Gaza in 2005, all of the army, all of the settlers. So this was doubly unexpected. And there isn't too much doubt that for most Israelis, this is the worst day in their history since the creation of the state. Now, this rage comes out in different ways, as Joel pointed out. Of course, first at Hamas, with this sheer savagery of the attack. After all, this comes on the background, which I do want to add here, of four previous episodes of fighting with Hamas, all of which followed a very similar pattern, a barrage of rockets from Hamas, an air campaign by Israel in two cases of the four with limited ground invasion, high Palestinian casualties, a ceasefire, claims of victory by both sides, and then Hamas rebuilds. Now, on that background, you can maybe understand better why in Israel the feeling is very strong that this time has to be different. There is a consensus on eliminating Hamas as a military threat and as the government of Gaza. The problem, of course, being that you really can't eliminate Hamas as a political force. That simply isn't possible. And that even to eliminate them as the ruler of Gaza can only be done with huge civilian casualties. Now, the other part of that anger is directed, as Joel pointed out, at their own government. And there will be a reckoning after the war, as there has been in Israel after every major conflict. I think he's correct that Netanyahu's days are numbered. I'm not sure what that number is, because he doesn't have to call an election legally for 3 years. I wouldn't bet, however, on his lasting 3 years. His 15% approval in the polls, and incidentally, on a party level, reduction of Likud from 32 seats out of 120 to roughly half, 16 or 18, and the major political party after the next election, whenever that's held, will be Benny Gantz's National Union, which is polling around 40 seats and will obviously be the center of any future government, barring a big change in that. Again, that might not happen for 3 years, but I would not bet on that. There'll be tremendous pressure once the fighting is over for immediate elections. And as Joel hinted, there's also a possibility of a split within Likud that could move things along. Now, it's not just the fact that the government was caught by surprise. As Joel said, there's been a series of revelations here about Israel's policy toward Hamas over the years. Presumably, there was a blockade since Hamas took over Gaza in 2007, 16 years ago. A blockade supported by the United States, by most Western countries, and by Egypt, to blockade the Hamas regime in Gaza, weaken it so that the Gaza population itself would take care of the problem. Now, these revelations point out that the Israeli government itself was undercutting this blockade. Cash was arriving from Qatar in particular, with the emissaries with suitcases of cash being escorted through Israel to the Gaza border, to bring this, to keep the Hamas regime alive, of all things. And there's been plenty of testimony about that since. And that, of course, doesn't do well for Netanyahu's popularity. Apparently, the thinking that Bibi, I'm not supposed to say Bibi, I was told that's a term of endearment. And you may have guessed that I'm not exactly a fan. But what he had in mind, apparently, was to keep the Palestinians divided. That sounds like a basic strategic maxim, right? And especially if you are opposed to a two-state solution, you do not want the Palestinians to get their act together. In retrospect, that may not seem like such a great idea, of course. Also, as Joel pointed out, Israel united magnificently in the crisis period. And he points out civil society was more responsible for that than the government. But there'll be tremendous division on what comes next. And in sense of his saying that the drift in Israel has been to the right, and pointing out, especially among the youth, I would just add to that, that this is not new. It's been happening since 1977. It's an expression of the demography of Israel, among other things. 20% from the former Soviet Union, who, given their experience there, became very nationalistic. 40% with a background in other Middle Eastern countries, very anti-Arab. The revisionist part of the original Zionist movement on top of that, put that together. In every election since 1977, except one, in every other election, the right and religious parties in Israel have had a majority. So again, this is nothing new. Well, for some of the many, or maybe even most Israelis, this shows this last campaign shows that a real solution is impossible, and that in fact a policy of preventing a Palestinian state is the only way to go. The more extreme elements among that all even talked about the reoccupation of Gaza, which I think Joel is correct in pointing out is not in the cards. This is not where most Israelis want to go. On the other hand, as he also said, there are people looking for a political solution. The realm of something like an interim authority that would take over Gaza in place of Hamas, preparing for eventual Palestinian self-rule, maybe with a renovated PA or something like that. That, however, is in the future. But it does seem clear in this arena that wars sometimes do shake people loose, shake up old thinking. After the 1973 war, we got a peace treaty with Egypt. After the First Intifada, we got the Oslo negotiations. So it's not impossible that the more traumatic an event, in fact, the greater the chance for something dramatically good as well as dramatically bad happening. Finally, let me just finish by echoing Joel's point about not thinking of this as a good guy, bad guy situation. Anybody who's been there knows that it's more complicated than that. Hamas is not representative of all Palestinians, any more than the West Bank settlers, who are terrorizing their Arab neighbors at present, are representative of all Israelis. In fact, I could go on about how the extremists on both sides are allies. They validate each other, and they need to be dealt with in that sense. So in that way, I also welcome this course, this lecture series, as a chance to practice civil discourse, is exactly what we need. Thank you.
Okay, so we have a number of very good questions. A lot of them turn around to touch on similar issues. They're supposed to show up there at some point. But anyways, I'll read them. So we are going to go maybe about 10 minutes over to make sure that we have some time to cover these questions. I'm just going to start reading. Please discuss the 21% Israeli-Arab perspective. And also, how would you feel as a West Bank Palestinian watching the settler movement expropriate occupied lands?
Well, one of the things that did strike me in Joel's interview was his report on the shift in Israeli-Palestinians, they call themselves now, the Arab citizens of Israel, toward greater understanding of what the Israelis were going through, because they are living there and they are a part of that society, which doesn't take away from their sympathy for the Palestinians, who at present time are going through a very destructive experience. Now, how this is going to express itself politically... Is this microphone working?
Yeah.
Great, okay. Remains to be seen. At present, there are two Arab parties in the Knesset with five seats each. That's almost 10%. But again, since Arabs represent 20% of the population, it's not proportionate. But when the Arabs did unify into one party, they got 15 seats. So where they're going to play a part in this is hard to tell. Obviously, they will be in the anti-Netanyahu camp.
Yeah. So your view on the genocide charges, and this is about the court case that was brought by South Africa.
Well, I just wrote something on that, so The genocide is covered by a very precise definition. It was a term that was only invented in 1944 by, incidentally, a Holocaust survivor, who defined it very specifically as the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a religious or ethnic group. And that's embodied in the convention, which the World Court is assigned to adjudicate. And according to that definition, as horrendous as what's happening now in the war, this is not an attempt to eliminate the Arab people, and really doesn't fit. Now, what the court's going to determine is hard to say. They do have the option of ordering changes in the way Israel is conducting this war without it necessarily using the word genocide, which, as I say, does have a very precise meaning in international law and to which this situation really does not apply. Does it apply to Hamas on October 7th? My view would be yes, in that case it does, because even though there's no thought of eliminating all Jews as a people, certainly the murders that were being carried out on that day were being carried out against Jews because they were Jews, which I think is a reasonable extension of the basic definition.
There's a question about Chaim Kassman's work. I'll just say that a lot of the references actually are, I think, available on the Strom Center website. You can go there and find his writings and references to that. There is a question, I guess this is to me, unless you want to take it, that is the Israeli-Turkish relations. So just briefly, like in many other places, foreign policy has become a very integral part of domestic politics in Turkey. And for his local support, internal support, Tayyip Erdogan always plays the anti-Israel card. And obviously, like in many other countries in the Middle East, there is a popular support for Palestinians. So he kind of knows how to stoke that and use that to his advantage. But at the same time, I should say that since about maybe a year before the war started, maybe even longer, trade between Turkey and Israel started to pick up again, and it continues to increase. That's a very important economic relations for both countries, and that is continuing. So about Biden, so could you comment on the idea that Biden has played the U.S. role in the war cleverly? And that's what Joel mentioned, given that resistance to the war among young voters in this pre-election season.
Well, I tend to agree with Joel on this, and I would be curious to know, we won't know until, you know, long after the event, what's going on behind the scenes when Biden and the Israeli government are together behind closed doors. You get some hint of it in what's reported, but it's very clear that there's a lot of butting of heads that's going on there. And in this sense, I think Joel's point makes sense. Biden's support publicly has been all that Israel could ask for. On the other hand, he does apparently have a broader goal and strategy in mind here, that is looking toward how you get diplomacy back on track after this is all over. And maybe at that point, if Hamas is not ruling Gaza, it does open up some diplomatic possibilities that the United States would have to be the prime mover on. So I'm encouraged by this, and I hope that there's some hard headbutting that's going on.
Yeah, in relation, I also heard that there's pressure on Israel, on Netanyahu, to release the tax that the Israeli government collected, release that money to the West Bank, to Palestinian authorities, so that they can start rebuilding some of their...
The other half of that thing I was talking about with Netanyahu, I wouldn't call it support, but extending a lifeline to Hamas, is actions that weaken the Palestinian Authority, again, keeping the Palestinians divided. And in this sense, I think there is room for the United States and others to apply pressure. If the PA is ever to function efficiently as a real representative of the Palestinians and partners to a two-state solution, it has to be thoroughly reformed and gain some credibility among its own people. And I assume that's what U.S. policy is trying to do.
Exactly. So there is a question here which will allow me to put a plug in one of the later lectures. The question is, can the U.S. maintain unipolar power while being active in Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, Red Sea? Is this overstretching? Does it make the U.S. vulnerable? We're very fortunate, actually, we'll have a visitor. One of the next to last lecture, actually, will be by Amanda Sloat, who was on the Biden's National Security Council until recently, and her main responsibility was actually Ukraine. And we want her precisely to address this question of how the U.S. responds to these crises that are coming without warning most of the time. So come and ask Amanda that question. The video and the lecture will be available after this. There was another question. So there are so many good questions, but I am afraid we'll have to end it here. Thank you all for coming, and thank you, Alan, for taking this over.